support for OPB comes from our members and from our sponsors, like Mike Rosenberg from Columbia Credit Union. Mike says they trust what they see and hear on OPB, and that aligns with Columbia Credit Union's brand.
It's OPB Politics Now for Friday, January 26. Oregon's grand experiment, decriminalizing drugs, could be coming to an end next month. Lawmakers from the state's majority party made a hard pivot and now support making drug possession a crime again. We'll talk about the politics of rolling back Measure 110 and also dig into the latest political squabbling between the city of Portland and Multnomah County after last week's storm. Welcome to the podcast. I'm OPB Politics reporter Lauren Dake.
I'm OPB's Portland City Government reporter, Alex Zielinski.
And I'm OPB Politics reporter, Dirk Vanderhart.
Dirk, we covered the 2023 legislative session when Democrats were adamantly opposed to making any major changes to Measure 110. Now we have influential Democrats writing legislation that would unravel the measure, which, again, to remind people, made Oregon the first state in the nation to decriminalize drug possession. There have been a lot of proposals since then to change Measure 110, but the one that was unveiled this week seems to have a real shot.
It does, yes. And just to be clear, what we're talking about here is this proposal that was released by Kate Lieber, the Senate Democratic leader, and Representative Jason Krupp, who chairs the House Judiciary Committee. These are two lawmakers who've thought a lot about justice issues. They're both attorneys, and in fact, they're both former prosecutors. And they were tasked last year with leading this effort to build a proposal for dealing with the state's addiction crisis and get it ready in time for this upcoming session, which kicks off on February 5th. That included, you know, this process has included running a special committee of lawmakers from both chambers. They've had four hearings on a wide variety of things and issues around this addiction crisis. And that all led to this bill that we expect to see in the session. It is House Bill 4002. And obviously, given that it's a bill that emerged after Democrats convened a special committee, that it's being put forward by two influential Democratic lawmakers, this bill sort of by definition has a better chance of passing than maybe some more hardline proposals from Republicans in the past, or just some that might come from a random Democrat without all this buy-in ahead of time.
And there's a lot to this bill. But before we get into the details, I think really the most eye-catching thing for most people will be simply that Democrats are now saying recriminalizing drugs is a smart idea. So are they admitting that their earlier stance on this issue was wrong?
They aren't. But you are certainly not wrong, Lauren, that they have pushed back vehemently in the past. You know, when people would call for recriminalization, Democrats have often said, no, that's way too hasty. We need more time. We need to give Measure 110 a chance to really flourish before we decide whether it's working or not. That has now changed. But I think what Lieber and Krupp would argue is that the plan they are putting forward is not fundamentally a departure from the spirit of Measure 110. As you say, the proposal would criminalize possession of small amounts of drugs for the first time in 3 years in Oregon. It would be a Class C misdemeanor to have small amounts of drugs, punishable by 30 days in jail, as opposed to the status quo right now, which is that's a violation. There's really no consequences. But Krupp and Lieber say this approach they're advocating is more about tweaking the thinking of Measure 110 rather than rescinding it. So remember, the measure was based on the premise that drug use should be treated as a public health problem rather than, you know, a criminal justice problem. And to that end, the state has been pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into expanding treatment options. But that's just not seemed to turn the tide, right, on this fentanyl crisis. We are seeing surging overdoses. Portland is really concerned about people openly smoking fentanyl in public. Voters are very, very upset. It has all sort of come together and demanded action of policymakers. Here's how Lieber described her approach to this bill that they have now sort of whipped up.
We knew that we didn't want to go backwards on what was happening with regard to either the, you know, war on drugs. We can't go back to that. But people are dying of overdoses on the street. People need to be able to walk down the street and make sure people aren't using drugs in front of them. And we knew we had to do something urgently, even though we have been investing in sort of treatment all along.
And you know, what Lieber and Krupp are really doing here is trying to walk this very fine line, right, between keeping that public health approach, not, you know, completely abandoning this principle of using this public health lens, but also giving police more authority to stop some of the things that Lieber is talking about, to intervene more forcefully when they see worrisome stuff on the street. And that, as we have seen this week, it seems to be a potentially very tricky line to walk.
So the Democrats are saying that they're keeping the spirit of Measure 110 intact, but they're also obviously proposing some departures from the measure. Can you just walk us through what would stay the same and what would change under the latest proposal?
Sure. You know, there is a lot to this proposal. I will try to just give some highlights. It will not be probably doing it justice, but you know, when it comes to making drug possession a Class C misdemeanor, Lieber and Krupp say that's necessary, right, in order to ensure, one, police can stop public drug use, but also to give them leverage to intervene on other sort of problematic drug-related activity that's playing out. But they're also really, really adamant that they don't want that to mean people are being prosecuted in droves just because possession is a crime. And so to that end, they are proposing a system where police would be required to give a person the option of meeting with a caseworker, having a phone call and maybe setting up a meeting rather than being brought to jail if they are caught with drugs. The hope here is that the threat of jail time and criminal consequences could nudge people to accept help in a way that is just not happening under Measure 110. And even if people did choose to go to jail under this system that's being proposed, there would be other options further down the line for them to seek assistance in order to get their charges dropped. Now, Representative Krupp says this is a way of responding to the complaints of law enforcement, who, you know, have said again and again they can't do much but write toothless tickets under Measure 110. Here's a little bit of what he said.
I feel like we're being responsive to what law enforcement says. We want to be able to investigate. We want to be able to intervene. We don't necessarily want to take these folks to jail. We want to be able to route them in the behavioral health system. So we've tried to craft policy that is mindful of what we're hearing from law enforcement and also mindful from folks that are worried about what happens if this is a crime.
And as I said, this recriminalization bit, it's going to be a big part of the debate, I assume, but it is just one piece. Lieber and Krupp are also proposing some new laws that would make it easier to prosecute people who deal drugs and also allow prosecutors to seek harder sentences if dealers are found to be targeting certain populations, for instance, people in treatment. But it's not just a criminal justice proposal either. There is a whole piece of this designed to improve access to treatment. Lieber and Krupp want to make it easier, for instance, for people to get medications that ease opioid withdrawal. One example is they want to allow pharmacists to prescribe those drugs if someone who relies on them needs it in an emergency situation. They plan to create a list of new treatment projects that they will try to get funded in the short term. They just want to really ensure there is a robust treatment plan in every corner of the state. So they actually say that this behavioral health side of their proposal is the piece that's ultimately going to help move the needle. And they emphasize something that a lot of people say about Measure 110 too, which is that Oregon put the cart before the horse here, right? We decriminalized drugs in February of 2021 without having anywhere near the treatment system the state needed to pivot to this public health approach. And so they are trying to sort of do something to address that, to walk us back a little bit on the decrim while we continue to bolster the public health side.
Well, like you pointed out, for the past 3 years, that's really been what we heard from recovery advocates and many Democrats, that basically, you know, this crisis unfolding on our streets was not because of Measure 110, but because it was just that the infrastructure, the addiction services necessary to make 110 work were not set up yet. So now what are the advocates saying about these latest proposals?
Yeah, as you can imagine, they are not happy, and I think that is probably putting it mildly. You know, virtually everyone, I think, expected Democrats would come to the table this year with some relatively meaty changes to state drug policy. I don't think anyone on any side of the debate, though, expected Lieber and Krupp would put forward a plan to recriminalize drug possession. At most, I think people expected there would be a proposal to outlaw using drugs in public. What we've been hearing from the advocate community who really back Measure 110 is a number of things. The first is they are adamant that this is backsliding to a drug war that absolutely failed, obviously, at ending drug use in this country, and in the meantime had a disproportionately negative outcome for communities of color. They also think this is just going to be an expensive distraction, right? We are putting money in this proposal into some new court-based systems, some other things that help law enforcement better interact with people and try to get them services. And maybe that is going to dissuade from the work that's being done already in just expanding treatment. And they note correctly, right, that the courts in many parts of Oregon aren't likely to be able to absorb something like this. Oregon has a public defender shortage that is already ensuring some people with low-level charges are being let off just because there's no lawyer to represent them. And so potentially flooding that system with thousands of new drug possession cases is not likely to work well. Krupp and Lieber say they're hopeful that people will accept the opportunity to take treatment rather than get charges. So maybe the system won't get flooded. That is obviously optimism. I don't know that there's any way to predict exactly how it's going to work.
Okay, so the advocates are not happy. And I'm not even going to ask you if this has made the Republicans happy, because I know the answer. But why don't you tell us why Republicans are also not happy when this is really what, you know, they've been asking Democrats to do for some time?
Right. Well, they would say it's not. I mean, the Republicans say this proposal does not go far enough. And it's not just the Republicans. Law enforcement organizations, DAs, the League of Cities, which speaks for cities across the state, all of them say that Lieber and Krupp have fallen short of a policy that's going to lead to necessary change. And that critique comes for a couple of reasons. I think the main component seems to be that they believe Democrats should make low-level drug possession a Class A misdemeanor rather than a Class C misdemeanor. That would mean that possession is punishable by up to a year in jail rather than a month in jail. And the argument here is that these groups just don't think the threat of a Class C misdemeanor is going to convince people to accept help. These folks all say they want drug users to engage with treatment, but that a Class C misdemeanor is just not a great enough potential penalty to get someone in the throes of addiction to do that. The other complaint they have is about this piece of the bill where police would be required to offer someone treatment rather than bringing them to jail. And if they didn't require, or if they didn't offer that treatment, a person could be let off. I think the people that critique that think it's going to create problems down the road and that it's going to be a tricky arrangement to make work in every part of Oregon. But just generally, here's the thing I find really interesting about this, Lauren. Virtually any time you have a major bill come forward ahead of a legislative session, there is some sort of coalition built in, right? It's often interest groups that have had a hand in shaping the bill behind the scenes and who are ready to advocate for its passage once it drops. This bill has none of that. I mean, virtually every group we've heard from and every group that is most outspoken about Measure 110 seems to deeply dislike it, often for very different reasons. And I just think that creates a political landscape that we don't often see around this proposal and that I'm very, very interested to watch play out.
Well, February legislative session will be a fun month, won't it?
Oh, it will.
Let's keep talking about what is happening on the streets of our state, but let's pivot to Alex. Last week, as everyone was trying to stay warm and avoid the freezing temperatures, City of Portland officials and Multnomah County officials were busy blaming each other for not adequately staffing warming shelters. And a lot of people were sent out into the brutal cold. Alex, what is happening here?
Yeah, it's a lot. So historically, the county and the city worked together to operate temporary shelters during weather emergencies, like warming shelters or cooling shelters when it's really hot. And that means quickly converting community centers or government buildings or even like nonprofit spaces into congregate shelters and also securing enough volunteers to help run them. But this partnership hasn't been perfect. It's also been pretty new. The fact that we've had so many extreme weather events in the past few years, like that isn't what Portland has seen, you know, over the past few decades, climate change is very real. So they're actually thinking about it in a more comprehensive way now. The two governments tried to kind of fix some issues with how these are being run with a new agreement signed just earlier this month before the storm, which really gave the county more oversight over how these shelters operate and are run. And it shows the city kind of taking a step back in some ways. You know, when the city is called to help under this new agreement, there are these new rules, like any city building used for an emergency shelter or relying on city staff needs to have security guards and special flooring to protect the floors. So this new agreement was really put to the test during the recent winter storm, which relied heavily on these shelters. The county saw a record number of people visiting 12 shelters, which they realized they didn't really have enough volunteers to run, so had to put out several calls to help in the middle of the storm when folks who might be able to volunteer were probably iced into their houses or maybe without power. The shelters kind of caught a lot of criticism for being short-staffed and for closing down, like you mentioned, while the city was still covered in ice and freezing rain, you know, 5 days into the storm. The city quickly put blame on the county for not being adequately prepared for the storm and for not reaching out to the cities for help earlier. And the county, meanwhile, said that the city dropped the ball in offering staff and buildings sooner in the process. And that, you know, if the city really cared about the system working, they shouldn't have signed on to that new agreement that really takes them out of the process. The county was also really upset that the city was asking for armed security at shelters, which the county didn't think was the right idea. This all came to light in a series of emails sent between Mayor Ted Wheeler and County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson just days after the storm ended.
And this is not the first time the city of Portland and Multnomah County officials have spent time pointing fingers and blaming each other while vulnerable people are without appropriate housing or care. Just remind us about some of the historical bad blood that exists between these two government entities.
Yeah, you're completely right. This has almost become tradition for bickering between the city and the county leaders to undermine progress. A lot of people blame the region's slow response to the homelessness crisis on past disagreements between Mayor Wheeler and previous county chair, Deborah Cafori, as the two didn't see eye to eye on where to prioritize funding. What's interesting is that Wheeler and Chair Vega Peterson have recently kind of gone out of their way to show agreement and unity on homelessness. Last month, the two announced a new contract agreement for the Joint Office of Homeless Services, where they pledged to be equally responsible for addressing some of the biggest barriers to moving people out of homelessness. But, you know, this recent disagreement shows that these two may still have some issues working together.
And I think it's probably safe to say this is not going to be the last big weather event we experience or the last emergency. And the fact that there's just so much internal political bickering and blaming does not inspire a lot of confidence in how these officials are going to respond. What are city and county officials saying about that?
Yeah, well, after Wheeler and Vega Peterson kind of hurled accusations at each other earlier this week, they sat down for a meeting to really discuss what worked and what didn't in the recent shelter response. And according to their offices, it went well. On Thursday, they released a joint statement essentially saying that they are in agreement to plan ahead better for severe storms to avoid space and volunteer shortages. It's pretty vague. I mean, it sounds nice on paper, but the proof will really be in how shelters fare during the next storm, which, yeah, could really happen sooner than we think and will continue to happen.
Okay, well, I'm sure this won't be the last time we discuss this on the podcast. Thank you both for joining me. That is it for this week's OPB Politics Now. This week's episode was produced by Andrew Thien. Our audio engineer is Stephen Cray. Our music comes from Audio Network. We will be back next week with more political news from across the Pacific Northwest. Until then, you can find all of OPB's reporting at opb.org. Thank you for your support, and thank you for listening.
I'm Alex Zielinski, City Government Reporter at OPB. We know you love hearing about the latest political battles on this podcast.
OPB's Salmon Wars podcast will give you insights into some of the history behind what's happening now. It tells the story of one Yakima Nation family who has been fighting for salmon in the Columbia River across generations. Find Salmon Wars wherever you listen to podcasts.